Some networks are, quote, smart. They offer sophisticated services that can be delivered to very simple end-user devices on the edge of the network. Other networks are dumb. They offer only a very basic service and require that the end-user devices are intelligent. What's smart about dumb networks is that they push innovation to the edge, giving end-users control over the pace and direction of innovation. Simplicity at the center allows for complexity at the edge, which fosters the vast decentralization of services. Surprisingly, then, dumb networks are the smart choice for innovation and freedom. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. And we are continuing down Anil's fundamental reads, the list of the Bitcoin essentials. And I will actually be including, and I'm updating this piece by Saifedean that we did. I'm updating the links or whatever so that I have Anil's. I totally forgot to put the link to all the reads in the show notes. So that should be there both in that episode as well as this episode. So if you were looking for it, my bad. Somebody actually pointed out to me. I can't remember the username, but thank you. Thank you for pointing that out to me. I can't believe I totally dropped the ball on that. But today we are reading a fantastic piece. And this is also a talk that Andreas, something that he's talked about so many times, Andreas Antonopoulos, the original, the legend, who supported and proselytized for Bitcoin for so many years during the bear markets and during the very, very early days, basically stipulating or basically articulating so many of the fundamental ideas that to this day are still spread and still argued and still insanely relevant to why Bitcoin is important and why it works. And this is one that I always thought was fascinating. And I also talk about at length in the guy's take after this, that it actually applies to markets more than I think Andreas actually understood, or at least more than he talked about. He always talked about it in the context of network architecture from the standpoint of just information networks, like the internet network and phone networks and all of those things. And I think it actually applies to legal, to language, to government and these other more fundamental networks that are largely social, like meat space networks that we don't generally think of in that context. And I think there's just something really, really fascinating to unpack there, as well as just being one of the critical and just amazing ideas to breaking down and understanding why Bitcoin is so potent as a technology, so unbelievably revolutionary, really. So really quick, a thank you to our sponsors who bring this show to you. We have the Fold app with the Fold debit card that gets you sats back on everything in your life, on my bills, on my Amazon purchases, and you know, more with gift cards. It is a literal cheat code for fiat to get sats back on everything that you do. And then where are you going to keep those sats? You're going to keep them safe, and you're going to make sure you have them on a cold card hardware wallet. Or honestly, a slew of devices that CoinKite makes available for secure Bitcoin hardware devices to keep your Bitcoin safe and make them easily accessible when you need them without putting them at risk to the device that you're using. Check them both out. You can get 50,000 sats for free by signing up with my referral code. And you can also get 9% off your cold card with using Bitcoin Audible. Both the links and the discount code is available in the show notes. With that, let's get into today's read, and it's titled Decentralization: Why Dumb Networks Are Better. The Smart Choice is Innovation at the Edge. Written by Andreas M. Antonopoulos. Published March 4th, 2015. Every device employed to bolster individual freedom must have as its chief purpose the impairment of the absoluteness of power. Eric Hoffer. In computer and communications networks, decentralization leads to faster innovation, greater openness, and lower cost. Decentralization creates the conditions for competition and diversity in the services the network provides. But how can you tell if a network is decentralized, and what makes it more likely to be decentralized? Network, quote, intelligence is the characteristic that differentiates centralized from decentralized networks, but in a way that is surprising and counterintuitive. Some networks are smart. They offer sophisticated services that can be delivered to very simple end-user devices on the edge of the network. Other networks are, quote, dumb. They offer only a very basic service and require that the end-user devices are intelligent. What's smart about dumb networks is that they push innovation to the edge, giving end-users control over the pace and direction of innovation. Simplicity at the center allows for complexity at the edge, which fosters the vast decentralization of services. Surprisingly, then, dumb networks are the smart choice for innovation and freedom. The telephone network used to be a smart network supporting dumb devices, telephones. All the intelligence in the telephone network and all the services were contained in the phone company's switching buildings. The telephone on the consumer's kitchen table was little more than a speaker and a microphone. Even the most advanced touch-tone telephones were still pretty simple devices, depending entirely on the network services they could request through beeping the right tones. In a smart network like that, there is no room for innovation at the edge. Sure, you can make a phone look like a cheeseburger or a banana, but you can't change the services it offers. The services depend entirely on the central switches owned by the phone company. Centralized innovation means slow innovation. It also means innovation directed by the goals of a single company. As a result, anything that doesn't seem to fit the vision of the company that owns the network is rejected or even actively fought. In fact, until 1968, AT&T restricted the devices allowed on the network to a handful of approved devices. In 1968, in a landmark decision, the FCC ruled in favor of the Carter phone, an acoustic coupler device for connecting two-way radios to telephones, opening the door for any consumer device that didn't, quote, cause harm to the system. That ruling paved the way for the answering machine, the fax machine, and the modem. But even with the ability to connect smarter devices to the edge, it wasn't until the modem that innovation really accelerated. The modem represented a complete inversion of the architecture. All the intelligence was moved to the edge, and the phone network was used only as an underlying dumb network to carry the data. Did the telecommunications companies welcome this development? Of course not. They fought it for nearly a decade, using regulation, lobbying, and legal threats against the new competition. In some countries, modem calls across international lines were automatically disconnected to prevent competition in the lucrative long-distance market. In the end, the internet won. Now, almost the entire phone network runs as an app on top of the internet. The internet is a dumb network, which is its defining and most valuable feature. The internet's protocol, Transmission Control Protocol / Internet Protocol, or TCP/IP, doesn't offer services. It doesn't make decisions about content. It doesn't distinguish between photos, text, video, and audio. It doesn't have a list of approved applications. It doesn't even distinguish between client and server, user and host, or individual versus corporation. Every IP address is an equal peer. TCP/IP acts as an efficient pipeline, moving data from one point to another. Over time, it has some minor adjustments to offer some differentiated quality of service capabilities, but other than that, it remains, for the most part, a dumb data pipeline. Almost all the intelligence is on the edge. All the services, all the applications are created on the edge devices. Creating a new application does not involve changing the network. The web, voice, video, and social media were all created as applications on the edge without any need to modify the internet protocol. So the dumb network becomes a platform for independent innovation without permission at the edge. The result is an incredible range of innovations, carried out at an even more incredible pace. People interested in even the tiniest of niche applications can create them on the edge. Applications that only have two participants only need two devices to support them, and they can run on the internet. Contrast that to the telephone network, where a new service like caller ID had to be built and deployed on every company switch, incurring maintenance costs for every subscriber. So only the most popular, profitable, and widely used services got deployed. The financial services industry is built on top of many highly specialized and service-specific networks. Most of these are layered atop the internet, but they are architected as closed, centralized, and smart networks with limited intelligence on the edge. Take, for example, the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunications, SWIFT, the International Wire Transfer Network. The consortium behind SWIFT has built a closed network of member banks that offers specific services, secure messages, mostly payment orders. Only banks can be members, and the network services are highly centralized. The SWIFT network is just one of dozens of single-purpose, tightly controlled, and closed networks offered to financial services companies, such as banks, brokerage firms, and exchanges. All these networks mediate the services by interposing the service provider between the users, and they allow minimal innovation or differentiation at the edge. That is, they are smart networks serving mostly dumb devices. Bitcoin is the internet of money. It offers a basic dumb network that connects peers from anywhere in the world. The Bitcoin network itself does not define any financial services or applications. It doesn't require membership registration or identification. It doesn't control the types of devices or applications that can live on its edge. Bitcoin offers one service: securely time-stamped, scripted transactions. Everything else is built on the edge devices as an application. Bitcoin allows any application to be developed independently, without permission, on the edge of the network. A developer can create a new application using the transactional service as a platform and deploy it on any device. Even niche applications with few users, applications never envisioned by the Bitcoin protocol creator, can be built and deployed. Almost any network architecture can be inverted. You can build a closed network on top of an open network, or vice versa, although it is easier to centralize than to decentralize. The modem inverted the phone network, giving us the internet. The banks have built closed network systems on top of the decentralized internet. Now Bitcoin provides an open network platform for financial services on top of the open and decentralized internet. The financial services built on top of Bitcoin are themselves open because they are not services delivered by the network. They are apps running on top of the network. This arrangement opens a market for applications, putting the end user in a position of power to choose the right application without restrictions. What happens when an industry transitions from using one or more smart and centralized networks to using a common, decentralized, open, and dumb network? A tsunami of innovation that was pent up for decades is suddenly released. All the applications that could never get permission in the closed network can now be developed and deployed without permission. At first, this change involves reinventing the previously centralized services with new and open decentralized alternatives. We saw that with the internet, as traditional telecommunication services were reinvented with email, instant messaging, and video calls. The first wave is also characterized by disintermediation, the removal of entire layers of intermediaries who are no longer necessary. With the internet, this meant replacing brokers, classified ads publishers, real estate agents, car salespeople, and many others with search engines and online direct markets. In the financial industry, Bitcoin will create a similar wave of disintermediation by making clearinghouses, exchanges, and wire transfer services obsolete. The big difference is that some of these disintermediated layers are multi-billion-dollar industries that are no longer needed. Beyond the first wave of innovation, which simply replaces existing services, is another wave that begins to build the applications that were impossible with the previous centralized network. The second wave doesn't just create applications that compare to existing services. It spawns new industries on the basis of applications that were previously too expensive or too difficult to scale. By eliminating friction in payments, Bitcoin doesn't just make better payments. It introduces market mechanisms and price discovery to economic activities that were too small or inefficient under the previous cost structure. We used to think smart networks would deliver the most value, but making the network dumb enabled a massive wave of innovation. Intelligence at the edge brings choice, freedom, and experimentation without permission. In networks, dumb is better. This episode is brought to you by the Cold Card Hardware Wallet, which now comes in colors, FYI. But the Cold Card is what you want if you want to know that you own your Bitcoin securely, that they are in your possession, and that those keys are not exposed to the surveillance and malware and security holes riddled in something like a smartphone, the issues with any internet-connected device. You keep your keys separate. This is the 100x, the 1000x security benefit that you can get with a Bitcoin hardware wallet, with the Cold Card hardware wallet. You keep your daily wallet on Lightning, or, you know, you keep some extra Bitcoin that you need to access quickly in just a normal wallet, maybe on your phone or your desktop, but you keep your savings on a hardware wallet. In fact, now with NFC, with the Cold Card and the Tap Signer, honestly, there's not a really whole lot of reason to have anything other than Lightning and then having it on your hardware wallet. I mean, it's just really, really easy to quickly send a transaction and just having your keys separate from your device. So whether you lose your phone, whether your phone is hacked, whether you click on the wrong thing in an email, your keys are never on your device. That is the assurance that the Cold Card gives you, that many of the devices actually at CoinKite and the incredible suite of Bitcoin hardware products that they make, they are a highly trusted and extremely long-running hardware maker in this space. And they are also helping to bring this show to you, and they are offering Bitcoin Audible listeners a 9% discount with Bitcoin Audible, all caps, all one word. Use that discount code at checkout, 9% off, and the link will be right there in the show notes. All right, I hope you guys enjoyed that piece from Andreas M. Antonopoulos, the original GOAT. Man, that guy, all complaints or claims of like, oh, Andreas did this or whatever, man, that guy was a proselytizer for Bitcoin and was so foundational in the proliferation of many of the core ideas and the principles of Bitcoin engineering, and so many things, like the way we think about development, the way we think about like the purpose of Bitcoin. And it's funny too, but he was never really a libertarian. It's funny, I feel like the one thing that Andreas, that I already had a foundation in, that that he never seemed to put above everything else, so to speak, or that he put kind of in his toolbox without making an extreme focus on it. He was very, very interested in the technology, in the idea of the network dynamics, in the peer-to-peer design and the architecture of all of these things, the dumb networks idea. I'm pretty sure that Andreas is the first one that I ever introduced the idea to me, and I've used the idea of the phone networks versus the internet as an example, God knows how many times. It's one of those things that I'd done it so long, I'd probably forgot, or I had kind of forgotten where it came from until I read this piece again. It's been a long time since I've read this piece. But Andreas has always had the perspective of understanding the technological dynamics, whereas my first touch point for Bitcoin was Austrian economics, was the economics and the game theory that kind of extended from the monetary nature of the protocol. And then I also was fascinated with the technological aspects, but it was less my forte. I mean, not that I wasn't technically literate. I always have been, but certainly not on the level of Andreas. I mean, he wrote Mastering Bitcoin, which, by the way, if anybody hasn't gone through Mastering Bitcoin, you are really, really missing out. I actually tried to do audio for that one. I think I've got like the first three or four chapters before it just got so difficult to make an audio version of it or to translate the usefulness in audio. And I realized it really needed to be a video series. And then at some point I just kind of dropped it or set it aside. I wonder where the hell that is. I bet I can probably dig that up somewhere. But it is an absolutely phenomenal work. And Andreas has been incredibly foundational to so many of the ideas around Bitcoin, around the network architecture and the engineering and purpose, why it could actually be sustainable, why it can actually work. And one of the crazy things about this dumb network idea that I always really loved is that without him realizing it is because he always seemed to actually be, he was never really a free marketer. He was in like a sense, with a lot of different pointed questions, if you asked him certain things, he would seem to convey some of the values and some of the principles of like free speech and, you know, that sort of thing. But then there were times where he would talk about universal basic income and a bunch of things that are completely economically unsustainable and antithetical to the very idea of, praxeology and why we can actually value things to begin with. But all that aside, one of the fascinating things I thought about, because this is one of the things that came to mind for me when I first heard the concept of the dumb networks idea, because it was articulating things that there's so many things where you're touching on this idea and you kind of understand it conceptually without being able to articulate, without being able to get that finely grained breakdown of what it is that you are beginning, the picture, like where are the concrete lines in that picture that you're beginning to see about how this thing works and why it is truly innovative. And, you know, what the nature of decentralization is, like the idea that the network is dumb is actually an indication, it's a strong characteristic to suggest that it is decentralization, that it's tied to the fact that there isn't some specific purpose for it, or that's not the word, or that's not the way to put it. There's no ongoing building of specialization and diversity within the rules, within the purpose of the protocol, within the purpose of the network, specifically because the only way you can have specialization and extreme diversity and variety at the edges is by having the network be dumb, by having the network do as little as possible just to articulate, just to make concrete the rules or the pieces of the puzzle necessary to enable the specialization. And what was fascinating to me when I heard this idea and kind of a extension or kind of cramming of ideas together that I did in the rabbit hole following that was that what he actually explained was the market economy without realizing it, that this is why the market economy works. So the purpose and the reason the market economy, like, so think about it in a context of like Bitcoin or TCP/IP, right? Is the reason these networks are dumb is they enable one concrete, highly valuable, and incredibly universal goal or functionality. TCP/IP allows you to transmit data packets. It doesn't care what kind. It doesn't do anything fancy with them. It's not about video or audio, and it doesn't treat them differently based on what kind of packet it is. It is just a dumb thing that functions as reliably as engineeringly possible. That's not a word. But as absolutely possible to get a data packet from A to B, from user to user, without a central authority. And one of the elements of the network itself, the redundancy, the incredible redundancy of the network was specifically to create a robustness and so that the packet would always make it. It's a way to create reliability among a massive network of unreliable devices. A router may go offline, a server may go offline, millions of users may be cutting on and off their devices, but their messages still send and receive. Their pings still get relayed. If one path doesn't work, it pulls back, it times out, and it tries another path. And by doing that, it enables the innovation in all of the other applications that simply can use that data connection. And in the same way, Bitcoin is that for money. It's that for permissionless value exchange and value measurement or value allocation. But you can go one deeper, that this is actually the foundation for the market itself. What the market is the entire space of voluntary interaction. Is how do you voluntarily trade with one person, between one person and another? Because only in a voluntary trade, only in one where people have the right to exit, that they can walk away from it, does a mutually beneficial trade actually take place. That it is explicitly win-win because both parties have the option of walking away. Nobody is being forced and nobody is being threatened to engage in the act outside of their own value judgment. And that doesn't mean that it's a perfect situation. That doesn't mean it's the best exchange they've ever had. That doesn't mean they're not reluctant. That doesn't mean that they're not, you know, grueling and have a dilemma and that there's not a crappy set of options. Just in the same way that you might not have a house, you might not have any capital goods, you might not have an economy to work with, and you might have to choose between sitting in the rain underneath a tree or maybe taking a risk and finding out if there's another animal in this cave that doesn't want you living in it. But the evil market didn't put that restriction on you, the universe did. But voluntary exchange is the only thing that we can actually know was mutually beneficial at the time per the assessment that it was worth it, per the judgment of the people in the situation. So what is the purpose of building a market? What is the purpose of the underlying technologies that establish a market? The money, the rules, the law. Its purpose is to be the dumbest network possible to establish a set of rules so that people can voluntarily exchange. Each person owns themselves. Each person has to agree to the exchange, and no outside party can threaten or violently steal in that interaction. No party can cheat, no party can steal. That's literally it, that's the whole thing. That's what it's supposed to do. And the more we try to make the network, the government, the rules, quote unquote, smart, the whole thing devolves into chaos, corruption, cheating, lying, and authority for the sake of authority. Why? Because we're trying to make a smart network where only a dumb network will allow specialization to actually occur. And understand, specialization itself is the market. It is the economy. It is civilization. It is the ability for me to raise cattle and you to farm corn and somebody else to build internet infrastructure that we can actually all have, that the guy who's building internet stuff, who's running wires, can still have a burger and eat some chips. And it's the only reason why the farmer and the person raising cattle can have internet communications. It is because of specialization. And one of the fundamental requirements for specialization, especially across any project or goal that takes some extended amount of time, takes weeks, months, or years to actually see through, is money, is the ability to save the promise of society to give you back your resources. Money is one of those dumb networks. The law is supposed to be one of those dumb networks. That's why the Constitution is written on like four pieces of paper. Really, the only thing you need for a market economy is the exact minimum of set of laws needed to establish property rights. That's it. Then you get the absolute explosion. The explosion of innovation and specialization that you can have, where you can have someone who literally make videos reacting to other videos and actually make a living from it. In fact, there's a really great quote. I think I've got this open somewhere. Hold on a second. With the magic of editing, I'm going to find this, and you're not even going to know how long it took. So, quote, this is from Praxeology by Knuts von Holm, which I'm finishing up the audiobook for. It says, quote, "The market creates an opportunity for human beings to engage in production solely for the purpose of trade. We can perform tasks demanded by the market rather than working for ourselves directly and achieve better outcomes for everyone involved. Exchanges occur because the innate inequalities between people and their nature-given resources. Voluntary exchange and the division of labor push us into more and more specialization. It causes some villages to grow into cities and others to remain farmland. The division of labor playing out for millennia has made us specialize to such a degree that some people now react to reaction videos on the internet for a living. Imagine the stages of production that had to precede such a profession. Every step forward on the road toward a market that satisfies the highest amount of human desires requires more advanced technologies. These advancements, in turn, require a further specialization of tasks. I thought that was just a freaking hilarious quote, the idea of people making reaction videos to reaction videos as a living, and the level of specialization in the economy has become so great, the sheer complexity from simply establishing a set of fundamental market incentives, fundamental market rules, and a monetary good that can communicate those, the values of the market participants, can enable specialization to this degree. Like, that's insane. That's absolutely, utterly fantastic to consider that that is enabled. Like, consider the freaking privilege that you live in a time in which you can do just that. And it's a way to provide value to other people, entertainment to other people for their leisure time, that would enable you to trade with them the other resources that they produce. The sole purpose, the fundamental purpose of the law, is simply to create property rights. Because only with property rights can you create certain capital that a certain person has both the responsibility over and the reward from its use, from its specific use. Because no property, no physical property can be used by two people at the same time. No two people can take a car and drive to two different locations at the exact same time. One person controls the car in physical space. One person controls the car at one specific physical time. It is a necessity. It is an axiomatic reality of the scarcity of a physical thing. And only if the owner is paid the reward or pays for the costs and the failures of utilizing that resource can they actually ascribe value to it. It is only in the context of what they hope to achieve, of their ends, and what they value, what they love, what they dream to achieve, and the vision they have for their life or for the world, that they can actually value their capital in relation to someone else's goals or what they hope to achieve in the world. Property enables you to care about a thing with skin in the game, and it enables the ability to exchange something, because the very idea of exchanging it is to exchange the exclusive control of it, the use of it for your ends as opposed to my ends. And money is a prerequisite to exchanging those things across the divisions of barter, across the divisions of scale, and across the divisions of time. These barriers to actually making that exchange, where I would need the, you know, the double coincidence of wants problem, right? If I catch a fish and you make shoes and I need shoes, I literally have to wait until you need a fish. Property rights alone only let me eventually trade with you so that it's worth it for me to get the fish, because I will actually have exclusive use of the shoes if I trade with you. But it doesn't solve the problem that you either need fish, or I got to figure out something else that you want. Maybe you need a shirt, so I got to find somebody else who's got a shirt who wants fish. Money is the universal communication tool of that value that bridges the time between when I caught that fish and when I need the shoe, when you made the shoe versus when I caught the fish, the distance between where you are when you have the shoe and where I am when I catch the fish, and the impossible divisibility problem of how much is a shoe worth measured in fish. Is it half a fish? Is it the front half of a fish? Is it the back half of a fish? Is it the head of, like, you know, how much of a shoe is a fish worth? Is it just the laces? We have all of these calculation problems, but when we have a universal medium, when we have a dumb network of a monetary good that has perfect divisibility, that has uniformity, where it can scale infinitely large or infinitely small. I can have 100 million sats, and it's literally exactly 100 million times the value of one sat, every sat is completely equal, and that I still have the same sat. The same sat is worth the exact same amount in relation to the rest of the network that is willing to trade with time that as time passes. Like, I know what its relationship is. And if it can fundamentally secure those characteristics that make a good money, and it can securely be exchanged, that's the crazy thing about Bitcoin, is that it actually establishes one of the most fundamental parts of the legal network within the money itself. This is one of those reasons why, when you dig further into it, you realize how many layers of kind of revolutionary shift Bitcoin actually is, because it's not merely... it's not merely a money in the sense that it is, but it's fundamentally a different type of money. It's an entirely new scale, isn't the problem. It's a new dimension of money in the sense that it does not require a legal protection. The point of the legal protection of property rights, again, is to establish a market, right? And then the money is there to actually enable the measurement and the direct exchange of those physical goods across time periods that the physical goods do not actually suffice, across the time periods, the geographical or the time scale, the geographical scale, and the divisibility scale, the scale of the size of the thing itself. So the property rights create the ability to value and create the ability to exchange, because you explicitly can only exchange exclusive ownership. And money enables the communication of that thing across three different forms of scale that any individual good can't actually provide, except for money. But here's the crazy thing about Bitcoin, is that the ownership is actually embedded in the protocol itself. It's not something that you have to... it's not defended in the physical world. I mean, it is, but it isn't. Absent of the approval of your jurisdiction, you can still own Bitcoin. Bitcoin only cares about your keys, which means that it actually solves the most fundamental problem in one half of every transaction that the legal system is supposed to solve. It solves a fundamental problem of government. It takes the soul of government and codifies it. It takes it away from an apparatus that has abused it, that has corrupted it, that has cheated it, that has basically devoid its soul of any integrity or any of its fundamental purpose at all. And it is basically beating the dying corpse of what the purpose of government even was, the purpose of the law even was to begin with, and instead has created this hierarchy of power, these two classes, multiple classes of people that actually get to abuse the violent interaction, abuse the involuntary transactions of society, and beat down and eviscerate all of the voluntary foundation of the market. It increasingly tries to smart the legal network and destroy all of its dumb aspects that actually provide the fundamental purpose that it's supposed to provide. And therefore, it doesn't provide any purpose. All it does is end up serving the goal or serving the visions of the centralized owners who are manipulating and corrupting the very purpose of the dumb network to begin with. The law becomes the source of anarchy in the sense of chaos, abuse, and corruption and violence. But Bitcoin codifies its most important element and just kind of pulls the rug right out from underneath them. That now the medium that communicates across time, geography, and scale actually establishes its most simple, fundamental, legal ownership right. An assurance. And if you have the key, they're your coins. I think it's really hard to overstate how revolutionary that concept is. And it's so revolutionary, in fact, that it takes decades and decades and decades to even unravel the importance of it and how it can be used. And I love the analogy or the talking about the process of reestablishing of a dumb network replacing centralized networks and how that plays out when we're talking about financial networks and monetary networks and these sorts of things, which Andreas talks about in this piece, right? Is that first you have to recreate all of the services and products or the purpose of the financial networks, the purpose of the payment networks. That's what Lightning is. That's what all of these different tools and structures that we've built on top of Bitcoin, the layer twos and the standardization of certain scripting languages and certain paths in the script of Bitcoin exchange in order to establish that network and to establish the liquidity needed in order to compete with the current dominant services that actually exist in these centralized permissioned networks. So that's the first major era, is to just build the replacements, to create the new infrastructure for an entirely different hierarchy of, or entirely different pyramid of money, of layered money from a decentralized base. But the crazy thing is that it's not just the financial. It's not just the monetary. It's not just the payment service that is being undermined, that is being obsoleted with a decentralized alternative. It's the ownership right itself. There is also a deeply political and legal obsolescence that is going on at the exact same time. And I think there's a really powerful hint of a powerful grain of truth in that, that leads to kind of enlightening the timescales that we're talking about here, and why I actually like Alex Svetsky's theory. One of Svetsky's pieces we read, the three generations theory, is that hyper-Bitcoinization will happen over three generations. And it's such a fundamental shift in the ideas of, like, so many people don't even understand how to think of ownership outside of the context of a government. They can't even imagine a society that would work differently, because the concept of authority is what would stipulate. People think rights come from government. Tons of people think this. Rights, actually, if you fundamentally understand what a right is, in fact, I've got a guy's take, I'll see if I can dig it up, about just the idea of rights, is that they are deduced from the fact that you exist and that your existence is yours, that you think, therefore you are. And from that, we can deduce that you are the only true owner of your body. And that if anybody extends, like, for someone to violate that, to rape someone, to enslave someone, to steal from them, anything that forces them to take their body and their person and use it for the value, the vision, or the labor to reward someone else, to violently enforce that, is to suggest that the victim doesn't own their body, even though they are the one who is thinking in their head. They are the ones who can control their arm if they attempt to move their arm. But that the other person not only does have that right, not only does own themselves and own their arms and own their labor, but that they also own the labor and the thoughts and the visions and the hopes and dreams of someone else, so much so that they can rip it from them and repurpose it for their own ends. Rights are deduced from the concept of existence, from the ability that you and I can argue. That is all we need to establish the fact that there are rights, that there is self-ownership, and everything else is deduced from that. It's the entire moral foundation for why slavery is bad. So when you start talking about how government should be able to take away from everybody and give to some other people, you literally eviscerate the logical moral foundation for the idea that slavery is wrong to begin with. It is an argument for slavery, just in a different flavor and a different degree. And in that world, you cannot have good markets. You cannot have ownership and individual assurances of what anyone values. And what you end up having is you have a corrupt, abusive, and violent society. It's the only end result. Because you fundamentally reward involuntary behavior, involuntary exchange over voluntary exchange. It's like, do you want a civilized society, or do we want slavery? Like, those are the options. It's either civilization or uncivilization. And just like Bitcoin, just like TCPIP, the dumb fundamental rights of the individual is exactly what creates the explosion and the unbelievable flourishing of innovation and ideas and specialization that makes the market economy that we know of today. It's not possible without it. It is a prerequisite. And until we realize that fact, where you're going to pay the price of our hubris of thinking we can smartly control society and top-down manage everybody's lives. We're going to lose the value and the freedom and the robustness of the dumb networks because we're going to think arrogantly that we can do it better. Anyway, I always thought that was a fascinating idea. Now Rad's come to see me. How was your nap, buddy? Yeah? Well, we're going to close this one out. Perfect timing, buddy. We're going to close this one out. A huge thank you to Andreas, even though he's not going to listen to this, but this was always a phenomenal piece, and I always thought it was so cool the degree of application you could take this idea and to understand these things like language, language and law and Bitcoin and TCP/IP, all of these things as dumb networks that enable the market, enable human ingenuity and innovation to actually occur in the first place, because they create that foundation that it's like the rich soil that allows it to grow. So with that, thank you guys so much for listening. Do not forget to subscribe. Don't forget to check out AI Unchained. We've got a couple of great episodes literally right around the corner. So subscribe to both. Links to all the goodies will be available in the show notes. And of course, do not forget our amazing sponsors, the Fold Card and the Cold Card. Get sats back on everything in fiat and put that shit on your hardware wallet. And I think you know where to find that too. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, everybody, take it easy, guys. Liberty is not merely one particular value. It is the source and condition of most moral values. What a free society offers to the individual is much more than what he would be able to do if only he were free. Friedrich August von Hayek.